you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Christopher Bolin on the show. Christopher is an American investigative journalist. He's the author of Solving 9/11 set of books and The War on Terror, The Plot to Rule the Middle East. He has a degree in history from the University of California at Santa Cruz with his focus on Israel and Palestine. He has written extensively about the Middle East, electronic vote fraud, the dangers of depleted uranium, and the history and geopolitical background of the terror attacks of September 11th, 2001. He has spoken about 9/11 in America and Europe and done several speaking tours across the United States.
The Solving 9/11 set of books are about the war on terror.
Mm-hmm.
Not specifically on the war on terror. The Solving 9/11 set of books are about the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and what happened on 9/11. And those attacks were done, 9/11 was done in order to make the war on terror operational.
Mm-hmm.
The war on terror is a fraudulent war in which the United States has been dragged into the Middle East to fight wars on the behalf of the Zionists, Israel. I wrote the book The War on Terror as a pamphlet, almost as like Common Sense by Thomas Paine, to alert my fellow Americans and other people about the true nature of the war on terror, because we have been deceived about both 9/11 and the war on terror. But, you know, here we are 17 years later. We're still fighting this war in the Middle East and North Africa. Thousands of American lives have been ruined. Millions of people in the Middle East have been affected. It's cost a ton of money. You know, as Donald Trump said, we've spent $7 trillion, trillion with a capital T, and we've gotten nothing for it. So in order for us to be able to resist the war, to resist the deception, you have to be aware of what's really going on. You have to understand what is the real strategic operational plan that is behind the war on terror. And that's what this little book, The War on Terror, is all about. So I made it very small and easy to read, very clear text easy to read, because it needs to be read by a lot of people. And it's something that's very small, can be read in a few hours and shared with your friends. That's the idea.
Yeah, and it is. I read it, and it is. It lays out the case. And on the back of the book, on the dust jacket, I guess, at the back of it, it says, the government and the media have misled us about 9/11 in order to compel public opinion to support the war on terror. We have gone along with it Why have we gone along with it? Do we accept endless war as normal? Are we numb to the suffering caused by our military interventions? No, we have simply been propagandized into submission. We have been deceived into thinking that the war on terror is a good thing, a valiant struggle against terrorists who intend to attack us as we were on 9/11. Behind the war on terror is a strategic plan crafted decades in advance to redraw the map of the Middle East. 9/11 was a false flag operation blamed on Muslims in order to start the military operation for that strategic plan. Recognizing the origins of the plan is crucial for undermining the deception that has changed our world. Now, that's quite a statement. It's completely different to the popular narrative of 9/11. So let's lay out the case. So it wasn't this rogue group, Al-Qaeda, that pulled this off, that outsmarted American air defense and brought down the towers and attacked the Pentagon and these things. What's the history of the war on terror? You go a little further back in history, and who was really behind it?
Yeah, well, the first thing to understand, as you've alluded to, is to understand that we've been lied to about September 11th. When you understand that, if you don't understand that, then you haven't gotten to first base. But if you understand that we've been lied to about 9/11, then the question is, well, why? Why did they do this huge deception? Why has the media and the government gone along with this deception? What's the purpose? What's the reason? Well, the reason is the war on terror. And the war on terror is an older doctrine, an older conspiracy plot that was rolled out publicly the first time in 1979 by Benjamin Netanyahu and his father at something called the Netanyahu Institute, the Jonathan Institute, named after his brother, in Jerusalem. And it was July 1979. It was a four-day conference. George Herbert Walker Bush spoke on the final day. He was running for president at the time. And this was when they first presented in what is what's called a propaganda offensive, with a lot of media people and politicians from around the world, 700 people assembled. They rolled out this doctrine, the Israeli military intelligence, that no longer would the main issue be human rights, but the new issue would be fighting terrorism. Terrorism, international terrorism. And at the time, 1979, middle of the Cold War, the Israelis put the blame for all international terrorism on the Kremlin. They blamed the Soviet Union for being the sponsor of international terrorism. This was, of course, done to bring the United States into taking on a new role in fighting the Cold War by fighting Palestinians. It was meant to delegitimize the resistance to Israel, basically. So the Palestinians were seen as proxies of Russia, and anybody who attacked Israel was a terrorist, and therefore they said it's the role of the West, the United States and the Western allies, to come to the Middle East to basically wage war against the enemies of Israel, because those enemies of Israel are fundamentally opposed to the West. So by lumping themselves, by grafting Israel onto the West, they said, it's your problem too. And this is the same thing they did on 9/11, you know, when they pulled over the Israeli intelligence operatives in New Jersey. The first thing they told the police is, hey, dudes, we're not Palestinian, we're Israelis. The Palestinians are the problem. The Palestinians are the problem, not us. So it's the Israeli way of thinking, is that constantly blame the Arabs and the Palestinians, while they themselves are actually the masterminds of the terror. So, well, if you read my book, Solving 9/11, The Deception Changed the World, you'll see all the evidence that I lay out to show that the September 11th attacks were a false flag operation carried out by Israeli intelligence and their agents in the United States. And then it was covered up. And instead of investigating the crime, the American public was given a prepared story, a narrative, starting on day one, basically, blaming Osama bin Laden and basically calling for the United States to go to war against Osama bin Laden. And that's where we've been for the last 17 years. And if you don't understand the relationship between the false flag 9/11 attack and the war on terror, you will never be able to get out of it. And, you know, look at the history. 17 years we've been in it. It's destroying America. People who don't think it's destroying America need to take a trip around the country and see what it's done. Americans are suffering. We've lost a lot of jobs. We've lost a lot of prosperity. We've lost a lot of prestige. We've lost a lot of our self, not self-confidence, but our self-esteem, because our nation is doing basically war fighting in situations where we shouldn't be fighting wars at all. Like the shooting we had the other day down in Ventura County in Thousand Oaks. This young man, he had been a Marine, U.S. Marine, and he had gone over there. His occupation in Afghanistan for about 7 months was a machine gunner. So he was a guy who rode around and shot the machine gun at people. And this obviously causes a great deal of psychological problems. You know, the one thing that you cannot recover from is wrongfully taking somebody's life. And he probably took more than one. And you know, he kind of lost his soul, lost his mind, and came back and lost his wife, was living at home with his mom. And I don't know, if he didn't do it, he made a perfect Manchurian candidate. But in any case, it looks like he probably did it because he was so upset with himself, so in such despair that he took other people's lives. So the whole thing is that we have to understand the war on terror, because the war on terror has to end. You know, Donald Trump's been president for 2 years. We hope that he'll come around to understanding that this is a rotten deal. He's pointed out on several occasions the cost of the war and the lack of any benefit for the American people. So let's end this thing.
You mentioned that 9/11 being a false flag. And in your book, and of course in your many lectures that you've given, it you can see on YouTube and in your other books, you provide a history of Israel's involvement in false flags. So if you can provide some of that grammar, maybe people wouldn't be so shocked to hear that 9/11 was yet another example of Israeli false flag, of another Israeli false flag attack. Yeah. So a brief history of Israeli false flags. Can you give us a little?
Well, that's the thing is, you see, I lived in Israel after high school. I went over there. I was traveling around the Middle East, and I wound up in Israel. And I learned about Zionism from Zionists who built the country, basically people from Eastern Europe who had come and settled in the Jordan Valley on one of those things called a kibbutz, a collective farm. And these people were, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Zionists from Eastern Europe who thought that their religious and their, I don't know what their mission was, to come and reestablish a Jewish state in Palestine. And that's who I learned about Palestine, and I mean about who I learned about Israeli history and Zionism from. And if you read history of Zionism, of the State of Israel, and before the State of Israel, you'll realize that Israel was created by terrorists, by people who used terrorism as their modus operandi. They we're talking about groups like the Lehi or the Stern Gang, Irgun, headed by Menachem Begin, and even the Haganah participated in things like bombing the King David Hotel in 1946 in Jerusalem, killing 93 people. At the time, the Jerusalem King David Hotel was the headquarters of the British authorities in Mandate Palestine. After World War I, Palestine was under a mandate of control by the British military. And after they blew up the King David Hotel, a few months later, they blew up the British embassy in Italy, in Rome. And they about that time, they also sent letter bombs to the foreign ministry in London. They also sent letter bombs to the Truman White House, something a lot of people don't know. But Truman's daughters had, you know, wrote about it, that the Zionists sent letter bombs to the Truman White House, very much like we're seeing today with these letter bombs or, you know, odd packages coming to congressmen, what have you. And then they in the 1950s, early 1950s, after Israel became a state, they used false flag terrorism in Egypt to try to drive a wedge between the United States and Egypt. And they put bombs in U.S. and British facilities like theaters and libraries and cultural centers in Egypt. And, of course, during the war in which Israel was created, they used terrorism to drive the Palestinian population out of the country. There was one massacre that's notorious called Deir Yassin, in which Menachem Begin and his fellow Irgunis, they attacked a village and massacred everybody and took a few prisoners left over and paraded them through the streets of Jerusalem. And this massacre was meant to instill fear in the greater Palestinian population so that they would flee. And it worked really well, because when you inculcate fear in a population, then they will become very malleable, very, you know, easily led. This is exactly what happened after 9/11, by the way. 9/11 was done to increase the fear factor in the American population. And then they went global by putting bombs in places like Madrid and London and Bali, so that the international citizen, the world citizen, became fearful and accepting of whatever remedy was offered by the authorities to eradicate terrorism, hence the war on terror. But then, you know, then they did other things. Like in the 1960s, the Israeli military openly attacked an American vessel, a Navy vessel, off the coast of Egypt. This ship was called the USS Liberty. And on June 8, 1967, the Israeli Air Force and Navy attacked this ship with torpedoes and with jet aircraft, and killed or injured two-thirds of the crew. The USS Liberty remains the most decorated ship in the U.S. Navy, and yet it's a piece of history that most Americans don't know anything about because it's suppressed, because it's a clear case of the Israeli military attacking an American vessel with the intention of killing all the Americans on board and putting the ship on the bottom of the sea. So these are some of the things that give you some background. And this is also the reason why, in my opinion, why Zionist history is not taught at American colleges. I studied history at the University of California, but this history is not taught, because if it were taught, the entire understanding, the American understanding of Israel and Zionism would be different.
Also, many people are aware of USS Liberty now, and also the Levon affair as it's become known. But one thing I always find interesting, or I find recently interesting, that even the 1983 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. the 86 bombing in the discotheque in Italy or Germany that was blamed on Muammar Gaddafi, as well as the Achille Lauro incident, mm-hmm. was there's a lot of evidence to suggest that these were indeed Mossad operations, Israeli mm-hmm. intelligence operations, false flags. Mm-hmm. And so this fundamentally changes the history of these events in many people's eyes, you know, how they remember them. Yeah.
There was a book that came out this year, written by an Israeli guy named Ronan Bergman. The book is called, Rise and Kill First. I think that's what it's called, Rise and Kill First. It's a book about Israel Mossad assassinations over history. And in this book, which was on the New York bestseller list this year, this Israeli writes about that the Israeli military had a terrorist operation running in Lebanon for 4 years, from 1979 until at least 1983, in which they would put truck bombs and car bombs in front of Palestinian buildings or Syrian buildings or Lebanese buildings and blow up the whole street. And as you said, in 1983, in October, one of the most notorious car bombings was that of the French and American Marine barracks, in which something like 271 Americans were killed. It was the worst loss of American Marines since the Iwo Jima battle in World War II. And the Caspar Weinberger, who was Secretary of Defense at the time, has said, even years later, that the United States has no knowledge of who did this bombing. In the popular history, if you read go to Wikipedia or something, they'll tell you that, oh, this is done by Hezbollah, it's done by Iran. No, there's no evidence whatsoever linking Iran or Hezbollah to this bombing. This was done by – and what we do know is that the Israeli Mossad knew exactly about the bombing. They knew the kind of truck, the Mercedes truck, the license plate, where it was being prepared. And they also knew when the specific time of the bombing, the date and time. Yet they didn't tell the American military any of this. And the head of the Mossad – this is written in a book about the Mossad by a former Israeli Mossadnik named Ostrovsky, Victor Ostrovsky. The book is called By Way of Deception. And he says that the head of the Mossad at the time said, no, the Americans are big guys. They can take care of themselves. Just give them the basics. And the basics were you know, a car bomb could be coming any day now. Be prepared. Well, it was Sunday morning, 7 o'clock in the morning. The Marines were all sleeping, and a big Mercedes car bomb just drove up the front door and blew up and killed 271 of them. And the evidence all indicates, this historical evidence that we have now, that Israel had been doing car bombs for 4 years in Lebanon prior to this, all being done by a secret group called Front for the Liberation of Lebanon from Foreigners. And it's most likely that they were involved in the – obviously that they were involved in the bombing of the Marine barracks. So this gives you some idea. When you understand this history, you understand that Israel is not a friend of the United States at all, that the United States – Israel has actually committed acts of war against the United States prior to 9/11, like the sinking attack on the USS Liberty. That's an act of war. So that basically they're not our friend at all. And they've attacked us before, and very viciously, and they do whatever they have to do to get their strategic goal achieved.
And you mentioned, of course, the Jerusalem Conference in 1979, this key event that George H.W. Bush and many other journalists and other government officials or former government officials attended. And you say this was sort of a laying out of a psychological warfare strategy for the next 30 years, planning what was going to unfold because the Cold War is coming to an end. Of course, you mentioned how they're trying to pin terrorism on the Soviet Union. That's beneficial during the Cold War era, that dialectic. But then the coming War on Terror, they had to sort of change the atmosphere of perception of things. And this is coordinated not only through the news, what we call the media, but also through entertainment and popular culture, correct? And it just seems to be coordinated.
Yeah, very much so. It's like in that conference was in 1979. It was a propaganda offensive to roll out the doctrine of the war on terror. But just the year before, Israel's number one intelligence agent, a man named Arnon Milchan, who's also known as a Hollywood producer, made JFK and Pretty Woman and Brazil, movies like that. This guy, his very first movie he made, he's an Israeli, he made a movie called The Medusa Touch, in which the climactic scene is a Boeing passenger aircraft smashing into the Pan Am building in New York City. And the very same year or the next year, the head of Israeli intelligence, a man named Yisr Harel, predicted to an American Zionist evangelist named Evans. He told him that Arabs would attack the tallest building in New York City. And he predicted. He made this prediction in 1979. So that you see, you have Israelis making movies about planes flying into buildings. You have the founding father of Israeli intelligence predicting that Arabs will attack the tallest buildings in New York City, and which happens, 22 years later? So it's like, what's going on here? These are just some of the basic clues that this was becoming a plot that was taking shape, that was being presented. This is something called ideation. The idea was being put out there, was being put out there in movies, being put out there in interviews, being put out there in books. His protege, Benjamin Netanyahu, after the conference in 1979, he started cranking out books in which he began pushing the idea of the war on terror as what the United States needed to do in the future. And in one of the books, I think the 1995 version of one of the books, he predicted – also he said that, if you don't do something now, the Arab terrorists might put a nuclear bomb in the basement of the World Trade Center, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's like all of this ideation is being put out there in the decades prior to 9/11. So that when 9/11 does happen, I mean, this is including the 1993 bombing, the TV shows and movies have been made about that. It's all been done to prepare the American public to accept the narrative most easily given that this was done by Arabs, and now it's time to go to war to wage war against the people who did 9/11. This is how it's done.
And the 1993 bombing, the truck bombing of the World Trade Center. A failed attempt to bring the towers down, as the official narrative goes, but you suggest that that might have been just an intentional failed attack to sort of get the public ready for it, for the eventual attack 9 years later. And of course, yes. people who've looked into that know that that attack was indeed a sting operation by the FBI gone bad. So there's that. All the FBI is all over it. But you seem to suggest that there's probably it was kind of like a hijacked or controlled Israeli operation.
Well, it was an FBI operation for sure. They were involved in it.
Yeah.
But then you had, you know, the prosecutor from New Jersey was a man named Michael Chertoff, and he's the guy who prosecuted it because the gang was hanging out there in New Jersey City or something like that. And so he was the main prosecutor, and he was then also the prosecutor for 9/11. He himself is an Israeli national. His mother was a Mossad agent, and he was raised in Israel and partly in the United States. And he was the assistant attorney general in 9/11. But what the 1993 bombing was not – they weren't really trying to bring down the World Trade Center. It wasn't going to happen that way.
Yeah.
What it was meant to do, it was meant to prime the pump, again, to prepare the American public for so that they would accept the 9/11 attacks as presented to them. What I mean to say is that there were movies made, for example, where – at the end of the movie, they have the terrorist in the back of the, you know, police car or whatever, and he's driving past the World Trade Center, and he sees the two towers. He says, next time we'll bring them both down. So the public then sees this and says, oh, that nasty Arabs, they tried to bring down the World Trade Center. So that when, in fact, the World Trade Center is brought down, you know, 8 years later, people naturally say, oh, yeah, didn't you see the movie? Yeah, that's exactly what they did back, you know. So that's how they prepare the public to accept their narrative, when in fact the evidence, if people look at the evidence, anybody with any you know, honesty who looks at the evidence of 9/11 will quickly determine that, you know, we've been completely lied to about what happened on 9/11.
Yeah, this is commonly referred to as predictive programming or cultural programming.
Mm-hmm.
Now. You mentioned people like Chertoff, this dual citizen whose parent mother is a Mossad agent, yet he's the U.S. Attorney General, then later head of Homeland Security. So you have someone, I guess, whose loyalties can be questioned just based on his pedigree, I think is fair to say. With 9/11, it was called an act of war, which is an important choice of words by people like Richard Perle and Dick Cheney. You make the point, because what this does is this makes it an act of war, and there's no real, I guess, political will for a sort of a detailed, thorough criminal investigation of the event. So all the propaganda can be utilized to create war fever and terrorize the public. What's the importance of calling this thing an act of war?
Well, an act of war is a legal term, and an act of war then makes it something that is then in the president's it's a war. It's an act of war. And then they say that usually an act of war requires a state actor being accused of attacking another state. In this case, they said this was done by this gang of guys, Al-Qaeda, from Afghanistan. Therefore, since they have the protection of the Afghan government, we will then wage war against the Taliban and the Afghan government. But the fact that they called it an act of war is very important. That was done on day one. On day one, it was determined that this was an act of war, not a crime. Before any evidence had been assembled, before any investigation had started, they said it's an act of war. USA Today came out the next day with a figure saying that 86% of the population said it was an act of war. And then the next day, of course, they passed this authorization to use military force bill in Congress, which was only one paragraph long, basically, and says that the president has the right to wage war against anybody who has participated or he determines, that the president determines, has any responsibility for the attacks of 9/11 or anybody who harbors them. And this, the meaning of this, the language of this has been a little bit, you know, strengthened or widened in the past 17 years, so that now this authorization to use military force has been used across, you know, a dozen countries in the Middle East. Not just Afghanistan. So it's very important to understand that by calling it an act of war, it precluded the possibility of or precluded the need for a proper criminal investigation. That's very important to understand. Americans need to understand that on 9/11 was the worst act of mass murder and terrorism in U.S. history, and it has never been investigated as a crime. People like to think that, oh yeah, the media told us that it's been investigated, everything's fine. It's never been investigated. Forget about it. The evidence was destroyed, and the nation went to war because it was declared an act of war. That's the important thing about understanding the difference. It's a legal term, and it took us to war rather than a criminal investigation.
What evidence has the federal government ever manifested or provided to prove, or at least indict Osama bin Laden as the ringleader in al-Qaeda?
None. Yeah. None, man. Don't you remember? I mean, it's like, was it Colin Powell sat there and said, "We have the evidence. We're gonna go to war with Afghanistan. We're gonna give you the evidence soon." The evidence was never forthcoming. Never. There's never been any evidence to make the case that Osama bin Laden did it, that Taliban had anything to do with it, that Al Qaeda, nothing. So they front loaded all of these claims in a prepared narrative, and the narrative was first given to the American public and to the world by the head of Israeli military, Ehud Barak, who appeared on BBC World Television just before the towers fell, or just after the towers fell, just very early in the day. And he said, oh, we know who did this. This is Osama bin Laden, and we know where he is. He's in Afghanistan. He said, now is the time for the United States to begin an operational concrete war against terrorism. That's basically it. So the Israelis interpreted 9/11 for us. And this is very important to understand. There was that General Wesley Clark, when he was running for president back in 2007, he spoke about this, and he talked about the memo that he was told about when he went to the Pentagon shortly after 9/11. And this memo, he said, said that the United States will overthrow 7 countries in the Middle East in 5 years. And he listed them. And it started with Iraq and Syria, and then, you know, Libya and Lebanon or these other countries. Sudan was one of them. And then it finished with Iran. And this is the memo. And this is the agenda. But he also said what we had after 9/11, he says, we didn't have American understanding of it. Well, what is he saying? What does he mean we didn't have American understanding of 9/11? What's he talking about? What he's saying is that we had foreign understanding of 9/11 provided to us. Well, who interpreted 9/11 for us? Was it the Germans, the Japanese? I don't understand. It was the Israelis. The Israelis interpret the Middle East for the American military 9 times out of 10. Because the Americans, the United States, we don't have the language people. We don't have perhaps a little bit better now, but we don't have the human intelligence, nor do we have really the inclination to be involved in the Middle East. This is Israel's, you know, backyard. And the Israelis have the inside edge in the U.S. Defense Department. And they – I mean, look at the Defense Policy Board on 9/11. It was all Zionist neocons: Paul Wolfowitz, Dove Zakheim, Richard Perle, Douglas Feith. This is the Defense Policy Board. This is the board of appointed people who craft the policy that the Pentagon puts into effect. Whoa! This is very wrong. But this is how it works. So these are the guys who crafted the policy of overthrowing 7 countries in 5 years. And that's where we've been for the last 17 years. Our system is broken.
Now you say the war on terror is a strategy that was laid out by Israel to achieve a strategic objective that they see in their interest. What is that objective?
Well, it's very interesting that you asked it like that. The Joint Chiefs of Staff in 1948, before Israel became a state, did 13 papers about what a Zionist state in Palestine would mean to U.S. military. And they said, they declared in the 13th paper that Zionist strategy would seek to involve the United States military in an ever widening and ever deepening conflict in the Middle East. And to achieve Jewish goals. And the Jewish goals, two of the Jewish goals that they listed in this paper, one was the growth of the State of Israel, the Greater Israel, into Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, etc., taking t- territory of their neighbors, growing in size and increasing their land territory. And secondly, to put into effect is Jewish hegemony over the entire Middle East. And that's kind of where we are right now, is that the U.S. operations in Syria and Iraq have been to break down the central authority and the secular government in those countries and to replace it with a broken, fractured country, which in a process called Balkanization, which is very similar to what was done to Yugoslavia. You take a secular socialist country like Yugoslavia and you break it into seven pieces, like Humpty Dumpty, and you never put it back together again. And those seven countries, little ethnic statelets, are poorer and weaker than ever. And that's the plan for the Middle East. That's what the Israelis want to do. It's something called the Yenon Plan. That's named after a guy named Oded Yenon. And this plan came out in 1982. He was an advisor to the defense minister at the time, Ariel Sharon. And the idea was that Israel would break up countries like Lebanon and Syria and Iraq so that they cease to be centrally operated countries, and they would instead be fragmented countries with ethnic groups here and there. And that's what the United States is unfortunately doing in Syria and Iraq.
And you see that more as just more than a coincidence.
Oh, yeah. Well, wait a minute. I don't know. You have to ask yourself, I don't know how much you know about the Middle East, but the United States has no interest whatsoever in Syria. We had some interest in Iraq, not much. But you know, this is a region that's not it's not our business. You know, we shouldn't be in Syria. We've been spending under Obama and Clinton, the United States began a program where they're spending $1 billion a year on covert militias to try to overthrow the government of Syria. Well, Hillary Clinton, in one of those emails that was released by WikiLeaks, she said that the best way to help Israel, she wrote, is to use force to overthrow the government of Syria. The best way to help Israel, she wrote. It's like, wait, isn't she Secretary of Defense for the United States of America? Why are we bending over backwards waging war to break up a country for Israel? Well, this is what my book is all about. You have to understand that the plan that's being put into effect in the Middle East, in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, is an Israeli plan. It's a Zionist plan to give them control of the Middle East, and in which the United States is being used like an ox with a ring in its nose and being pulled by the nose to trample this state, trample that state, trample this state. And this is an abuse of the American military. The American military needs to be pulled out of these areas, to be extracted from these criminal wars, and we need to separate U.S. interest from Israeli interest. You know, but what's happened in the last 20, 30 years is that the Israelis and the Zionists have taken control of they've hijacked our nation militarily, financially, in many ways. You know, they've hijacked our country.
Yeah, the financial angle is very important to understand, because if you look at it, the final analysis, these expensive wars that are paid for with borrowed money are from central banks that are ultimately owned by groups like the Rothschilds.
Yes, yes. I mean, by indebting the country to the degree that we become indebted, the banksters who control the debt, who buy the debt, become the creditors. They become like the overlords of our nation. And like Donald Trump, for example, he has a history with these Rothschild bankers. Mm-hmm. He went bankrupt a few times, but at the same time, he knows the importance of money. He knows the importance of getting a good deal. He has spoken about the bad deal that we have in the Middle East with vis-a-vis the war in Syria and Afghanistan. So, Mr. Trump, do something about it. And if he doesn't do something about it in the very near future, I can't see how anybody can take him at his word, because he has said time and time again that we are spending way too much money, and now this shooting down in California, in which the guy was a veteran from Afghanistan, you know, it's not a matter of guns. It's not that that we have a problem with guns in America. You know, the Swiss have guns and the Israelis have guns. We have a problem with a generation of young people who have been indoctrinated with violence, trained and turned into, you know, machine gunners like this young man, and they come back to their civilian life in America and they're lost.
Yeah, the war comes home, and
yeah.
Some people even trace many of the serial killers of the 70s to the Vietnam War. Sort of the cultural degradation that ensued in these things.
Yeah.
You can't really look at these things in a vacuum or separate them from their cultural historical context. A good example, just even the $38 billion that we're going to be giving the Israel the next 10 years, I think, is borrowed money from Rothschild-controlled banks. And that just is the financial trickery. Where's U.S. Congress in this? They're supposed to... We're mentioning the abuses largely of the executive branch. But where is our Congress, the representative of the people, and exercising some oversight? Have any insights on that?
They're completely beholden to this Zionist monster. I mean, it's like they're the ones who authorized this payment. This, you know, it was a bill that was crafted by Congress that was then signed by Obama to give Israel the $38 billion over 10 years. It was a large increase in their yearly stipend. You know, you look at what happened when this Netanyahu is one of the architects of terrorism. He's one of the architects, masterminds of the 9/11 attack. And when he spoke to Congress, a joint session of Congress, he got something like 29 standing ovations, more than the president. I mean, people, anytime he used the word stand, for example, people would stand up and applaud him. Yes. Well, he hadn't said anything important.
It's Stalinist almost.
It's bizarre. Yeah. I mean, just look at it sometime. Look at this event. He says, like, stand, and the whole Congress stands up and applauds this guy. Oh, he hasn't said anything. You know, there's no – so they're like trained SEALs, you know? And this is the problem. I mean, I can understand why Congress has such low popularity ratings among American people, because they are completely – They're venal. They are operating. They are serving their paylords, their paymasters, and you know, the Zionist influence in Congress has to be eradicated. You know, we have to pass laws to prevent. You know, one thing we have to do is we have to make AIPAC, Israeli lobby, they have to register as a foreign lobby, for crying out loud. American Israel lobby is lobbying for the state of Israel. They should be declared a foreign lobby, a foreign interest group, and treated as foreign agents. And
I think
the last president
to try to do that was John F. Kennedy, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, this has to be done. And you know, this idea that people can be dual nationals, have two passports, and serve the U.S. government, wrong. I mean, it never was like that before in the past. It shouldn't be like that, because a man cannot serve two masters. You know, like a person like Sheratov can't serve Israel and America at the same time. And what he did with the 9/11 non-investigation, he was serving Israel. There was no investigation of 9/11 because the person responsible for the investigation of 9/11 was an Israeli agent, Michael Chertoff.
Yeah, you make that point. There's a series of key moments. There's Zionist agents that are there to stifle any real investigation, right?
At every point, and so that it's become 100% consistent. So that, you know, when you now find a new important angle that you need to – that it's clearly something's been covered up. For example, the last one I recall was the NIST report, 2005, I think it was, NIST report on the collapse of the buildings. And this report was clearly a cover-up. This is where NIST, National Institutes of Standard and Technology, they investigated the collapse of the buildings, but they didn't pay any attention to any evidence of explosions or explosives or any evidence of molten metal. In fact, one of the engineers who wrote the report denied that there was any molten metal seen at the World Trade Center. And it's like, dude, it's all over the place. It's in the basement. It's falling off the building. It's in the dust. It's everywhere. I mean, molten iron droplets are a signature characteristic of the dust of the World Trade Center. So, you know, then I said, well, who wrote this report? Who was the mastermind? Who was the person behind the production of this report, the NIST report? And I looked and looked, and I found the guy was an actor, a short-term director of the NIST part of the government, sub-agency of commerce, I believe. And his name was William Jeffrey. And I thought, okay, I looked to find out more about William Jeffrey. I couldn't find anything. I spent a whole day looking for who this William Jeffrey was, because his history says that he grew up outside Chicago in a place called Arlington Heights, which is very close to where I grew up. So I was interested, who is this guy? And then I found out that his parents had changed their name. They'd gotten married, went down to Florida, changed their name from Jeffrey to Jaffe, or from Jaffe to Jeffrey, and then moved to Chicago and presented themselves not as Jewish, but presented themselves as Roman Catholics. And often didn't get their name spelled right. I mean, the first name was – so they were playing around with their names because they had taken on a new identity. They had become Catholics, and they had changed the name from Jaffe to Jeffrey, and their son was William. And this guy became a very big shot in advanced military technology in the government, and then he was appointed to head this NIST report to explain the collapse of the World Trade Center. And in this is a completely fraudulent report. Now, this is criminal. This is all criminal. All, you know, from Michael Sheratov's obstruction of justice, the destruction of evidence, the crafting of fraudulent reports like the NIST report, this is all part of a huge criminal conspiracy to defraud the American people. And people like Mr. Jeffrey and Michael Sheratov and John Ashcroft and Dick Cheney and George Bush, they all have to be basically arrested and put on trial.
So basically with this character Jeffries, this is sort of a crypto issue or an agent. This is an old strategy, just, you know, mm-hmm. Assuming a different name, claiming a false conversion, and then, you know.
Yeah, but what's important is that the way it came up to me is, you see, it came up through Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Mm-hmm. They presented this little bit in which they blamed the two engineers, Shyam Sundar, a guy from Iran, I think it is,
yeah,
and the other guy's name, John Gross. Mm-hmm. He's the engineer who spoke down in Texas and said, "We don't see any evidence of molten metal anywhere. I don't know what you're talking about. There's no molten metal." When molten metal is all over the place, as I said, on 9/11. It literally cascaded off the South Tower for 7 minutes before the building fell. It was found in pools under all three towers that fell that day. Pools. It was found in literally molten iron was found at the basement level, at the sub-basement level, at the bedrock level of all three towers. And as I said, it was found in the dust of the collapse.
Sure,
So it's like it's everywhere. For him to say it didn't exist – this is a flat-out lie. And AE 9/11 Truth were pointing at these two men, but I said, no, it's not the engineers. They didn't craft the policy. It's the guy on top. It's their boss. You know, Washington is a hierarchy. And that's why it was important to find out who the director was. And it was, as I said, William Jeffrey, formerly known as Jaffe. And this is what I'm saying is that this is showing one more time when you're looking for the missing piece and you find the missing piece – it's got the Star of David on the back of it. You know, yeah. you got a Zionist. It's not a Jewish thing. The Star of David is not a Jewish symbol. The Star of David is what they call the Star of David, is a Zionist symbol. It was adopted as a symbol of the state of the Zionist movement in 1897 in Basel, Switzerland. It's not a Jewish symbol at all. So it's very accurate to use this symbol, because this symbol, the so-called hexagram, the Zionist symbol, is in fact the symbol of Zionism in Israel. And those are the people who we find are responsible for the cover-up of 9/11.
And the same thing, I guess you could say, with the 9/11 Commission with Phil Zelikow, right?
Oh, yeah. Phil Zelikow, you know, it was supposed to go originally to Henry Kissinger. He wasn't willing to release his client list, and so it went to Philip Zelikow. And Zelikow is a master. His degree his thesis was on the creation and maintenance of the public myth. So he was a person who has studied and was prepared to create a myth. And they're thinking of these people, these oligarchs, is that you just give the people myths, give them mythology that they can live with. You know, so that they're running around in this myth, and that's the attitude of these people who think they're so superior to us. who are running our society.
This is Leo Strauss, the noble lie. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Noble, nothing noble about it.
No, yeah.
And it's getting more and more and more, you know, like, I don't want to get into details, but like the situation right now in California with the fires and with the chaos, with the shootings and the fires. Yeah. And this is intentional. This is not happenstance. Things like this, you know, California fires, you know, they happen. California wildfires happen. But the first thing that they usually do in the old days is they want to find out who caused the fire, where it started, and who caused it. Because these are arson. These wildfires are arson. Somebody started the fire. You know, either happened by accident, like I think they're trying to say the California Power Company was responsible for the Thomas Fire in Santa Barbara. But, I mean, it's like something happened to spark the fire. It's not lightning.
Well, I mean, you have oligarchs, people like Soros or Sheldon Adelson Sheldon Adelson says we should drop a nuclear bomb on Iran, and yeah. George Soros is busy destabilizing countries, even to the United States with Antifa and these things, but also the open fomenting of civil wars in places like Syria, Libya, and these things, and causing the migration, the population problems there, the refugee migration problem, which is then spilling over into Europe and destabilizing, causing problems in those countries. So if they're willing to do all that, I mean, you know, obviously they're willing sow chaos in whatever ways, even domestically, if they can harbor some benefit, you know, garner some benefit from it.
Domestically, domestically is you can't call it domestically when George Soros is a Hungarian Jew. He's imported. He's a villain from abroad.
Yeah.
But and they are trying to foment war in our country as well. They're trying to foment, factionalism. They're trying to divide us by, ethnic group or political ideology, what have you. That's what I'm saying is that they're waging war against us. And they've been waging war against us since 9/11. You know, 9/11 was an act of war against – it was an act of war not by Afghans or al-Qaeda, but it was an act of war by the culprits against the American people. That's why it's so important for us to understand who did 9/11 and why it was done, which is why my books are really important, because if you understand why – who's behind 9/11 and why it was done – you liberate yourself from all this madness and this deception, and you can begin to see the world a little bit more clearly and understand who is the real enemy. And you have to understand who your enemy is if you intend to fight a war.
Part of it, of really understanding the events of 9/11 is I've looked into, and I've also studied the research of yours and others regarding sort of the World Trade Center project itself, the Port Authority. It had become sort of this, at least from what I gather from what you've written or others written, sort of this a nest or a cabal of Zionist criminals. Is that a fair characterization?
Now, where is this nest of criminals? I missed.
Well, the New York and Jersey Port Authority. Yeah. You know, so the whole thing going on in the months leading up to it. I mean, I'm talking about who's Larry Silverstein? Who's Lauder? I mean, who are these people?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. The Port Authority is, as you said, the public owner of the World Trade Center, was the public owner. And in order for their plot to go ahead, they needed to basically obtain the ownership of the World Trade Center. So they needed to privatize it. And then to make money off of it, they had to, insure it. And so what happened was that Ronald Lauder, who the son of Estee Lauder, he was the director of the privatization board under Governor Pataki for New York State. And he decided that they would privatize the World Trade Center. Then, through some very convoluted negotiations, the World Trade Center was turned over to Larry Silverstein, who didn't have the money to – he didn't have the money to do this. But
he owned a strip bar or something?
He had owned a strip bar called Runway 69. Yes, in Bronx, I think it was.
So he comes from that sort of milieu or community?
Yeah, the thing is that there's the Larry Silverstein, who is Larry Silverstein? I've written about this because it's a little bit of a mystery.
It's like Jeffrey Epstein, right?
A little bit mystery like Jeffrey Epstein, exactly. Because there are claims that these are two Larry Silversteins, or the Israelis tend to think that it's the same guy. But in any case, he was involved in he was also named in a lawsuit, by the way, Larry Silverstein, in a lawsuit with Bill Clinton and others regarding drug smuggling. So, in any case, he wound up getting the World Trade Center with borrowed money that he put down, and the borrowed money came from GMAC, General Motors Corporation's, financial arm, which went bankrupt in 2008. Mm-hmm. So he wound up getting the buildings and then immediately insured them against an act of terrorism, and at the same time increased the rents 40%, and also insured his rents, by the way. So then when 9/11 happened, he wound up getting, after a little bit of litigation with another Zionist judge, Mukasey, he wound up getting a payout of something like $5.2 billion or $5,200 million for a down payment of $100 million of borrowed money. So it's quite a bonus he got that day. And he's the owner of the big, World Trade Center now. And if you have been down there to the new World Trade Center site, there's like these pools, there's some memorial there at where the two buildings once stood. And that memorial itself was also built by the Israelis. So it's like every single aspect of this is Israeli controlled. And people are trying to tell me that the Saudis did this or the inside job did this. How can it be that the Israelis control every aspect of this and obstruct justice, prevent an investigation, destroy the evidence, and they're doing this on behalf of the Saudis? I don't think so.
Controlling the perception is so key to this because there's so much evidence, so many at least grounds for questions or investigations, yet the media, the mainstream media, the ABC, CNN, CBS, Fox News, New York Times, Washington Post, where are they, right? But then again, if you look at who controls the media, we're in the same, we find the same problem, right?
Right. And the media is the most important part, actually. The media is complicit in this crime. The owners of the media are complicit in the cover-up. Because now for 17 years, they have never investigated anything about 9/11 beyond the official version that they trumpeted. So it's like, the media is supposed to, in a democratic state, the media is supposed to keep the government in check to prevent, egregious offenses being done by the government against the people. In this case, we have a very egregious offense being committed. And yet the government and the media have both covered it up, which means that the government and the media that we have in our country today are controlled by the people who carried out 9/11. That's the situation. When you understand that, then you can appreciate our political predicament.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And just a handful of corporations, maybe five or six, that are all interlocked.
That's right. And six corporations. Six corporations control over 90% of all the media in the United States of America.
And they're clamping down on the internet with Google and YouTube and these things and Facebook. They've sort of concentrate these things, then they're able to clamp down when have to stifle our alternative views in these things. It's a very critical situation, very dangerous situation
But the thing is that the internet is really quite democratic. I mean, if you ignore the monopoly positions of people like Google and Yahoo, the media still the internet as a tool, a communication tool, democratizes information, and that's to our advantage. If we didn't have the internet, we would not have any understanding of 9/11 other than what the media tells us.
No, I wouldn't even know who you are.
Right. And we wouldn't be able to have this conversation tonight.
Yeah, yeah. Now, where's my next question? I was going somewhere with this. The war on terror. How much are we spending a day on this thing?
Oh, that's a good question. It's I just looked at it the other day. It's $32 million an hour. It's $280 billion a year. It's a lot of money. $32 million per hour. Multiply that by 24. That's a daily price, and then work it up. And it's a hell of a lot of money. I think it was $280 billion a year we're spending, and it's being wasted. You know, it's a lot. Some of that money is going to the TSA and those blue shirt guys at the airport who make you wait in line for hours to get checked. And then some of it's being spent in Iraq and Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a very expensive operation, actually. Until recently, the figure was $4 million per hour in Afghanistan, which was, like $100 million a day. So why are we doing this? Why are we in Syria? Why are we in Iraq? Why are we in Afghanistan? What is our interest as Americans? There is none. Which is why Americans should be demanding that our soldiers be brought home. We have not, there's no declared war between us and any of these countries. So why are we there? Now they're talking about, they're talking about decades-long occupation in Syria and Iraq, what have you, Afghanistan.
Yeah,
this is madness. This is sheer madness.
Well, Americans have become habituated to militarism. This goes back to even the NSC 68 and the idea that you had to have sort of military Keynesianism, large defense spending to support the economy, and then you got to create the enemy to just fight the military spending in these things. But Americans in many ways have become habituated to having hundreds of bases overseas, having these wars being fought or dust ups or whatever. You make the point that you learned recently that a couple soldiers died in Niger. Well, what are American troops doing in Niger? Americans don't even know.
That's right.
And I remember I was watching a couple of years ago, I was watching the Super Bowl, and there's an ad, in between, during a break, a commercial break, and the ad is, I think it's for Lockheed Martin, perhaps, mm-hmm. and it shows a base in central or eastern Poland, a marine base, mm-hmm. and they're watching the NFL, and our troops are being entertained by the NFL, and, mm-hmm. and it's a cold base. I guess it's around Super Bowl time, so it's January or February. Mm-hmm. But of course, the suggestion is that our troops are defending freedom on the borders of Poland and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that we should accept. This is normal.
Mm-hmm.
Or Okinawa, right. for that matter, or even still in Germany. Germany's still occupied, right? I mean, it's
right.
incredible.
Right. Good point. That's a very good point. It's unusual that I hear an American say such a thing. Yes, Germany is still occupied. World War II has not been legally closed. There's no peace treaty between the United States and Germany. So there are a lot of things that are in limbo. That's why Russia maintains its presence in Kaliningrad, in Königsberg. They were only told they could stay there until there's a peace treaty with Germany. And until a peace treaty happens, they're allowed to stay there. And it's interesting that Putin, when he was visiting, I think it was in Japan a couple months ago, he offered off the cuff, he offered Japan a peace treaty to end the war with Japan. And I thought that was quite a bold thing for him to talk about this, because Russia is a beneficiary of the fact that there is no peace treaty with Japan, or in this case with Germany vis-a-vis the United States. So, yeah. There is a war party. There is very much a war party. You live in Northern Virginia. You understand that. Just take the metro through Pentagon Station sometime. And there is a war party, a very, very big war industry in the United States of America. But there is a foreign influence in this war party that is able to manipulate the United States into foreign wars that are not in our interest. And what's really necessary is that the United States – that we go back to the strict constitutional interpretation of who can declare war, and it's only Congress that can declare war.
Yeah, yeah.
By allowing the executive to wage wars here and there willy-nilly under the authorization to use military force after 9/11, we've opened up a can of worms, and we have absolutely – this has to come to a screeching halt.
Yeah, at least prior to the Korean War – when they lied us in the war, the president had to go before Congress and request a declaration of warfare. didn't prevent those wars, but at least they had to go through the motions. But you do make a good point about the involvement of foreign influence, and this was something even George Washington, warned against, these foreign entanglements of these things, how we would become enslaved to foreign interest. And that is the history of the United States going back at least as far back as the early 20th century. It isn't just Zionist or Jewish. It's of course you had British, or primarily the British, and their influence in America, especially in regards to the First and Second World Wars, the influence of British intelligence, William Stevenson, mm-hmm. a man called Intrepid. But it became sort of Anglo-Zio because you had this strange relation between the British Empire and Zionism, and also mm-hmm. Freemasonry, which I haven't quite figured out yet, honestly. It's just mm-hmm. interesting. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. But nevertheless, at the end of the day, you have foreign interest sort of inveigling themselves and taking over, primarily the East Coast establishment, because you had the dynamic during the Second World War, at least to run up to it, when Roosevelt was dragging us into the war. Midwestern opposition, particularly expressed in the American First Committee. And that mm-hmm. became a target of the ADL and the FBI because of their opposition to Roosevelt's policies. They were a loyal country. In fact, they had reports from Catholic FBI agents, because for some reason the FBI always attracted Catholics. That's one way the Empire mm-hmm. attracted Catholics, was the FBI. But you had these FBI agents writing Hoover saying that the American First Committee was not a German agent. They weren't German spies, just loyal Americans, and they should not be harassed. The mm-hmm. FBI agent was perhaps naive because the Empire was not going to brook such opposition. They were going to get their way. And largely, this was the drive to war then was largely British and also, Jewish too at the time, and mm-hmm. Charles Lindbergh was right when he said that. mm-hmm. In fact, they claimed they boasted after the war. I think it was Ginsburg's book, "The Fatal Embrace," about he said how Jewish organizations boasted after the war that they were pivotal in getting the United States into the war to defeat Hitler. So they admit,
right. And it's not so much Jewish organizations as Zionist organizations, mm-hmm. like the Balfour Declaration that from 1917. That is basically the birth certificate for the State of Israel, yeah. was a personal letter written to Lord Rothschild. And Lord Rothschild is the head of organized Jewry in Britain. And the reason for the Balfour Declaration in Britain promising support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine was to get the United States into the war on the side of Britain and to get American Jews to support the war effort. And yeah, it worked.
Yeah, like I think it was like Untermeyer and Brandeis and those guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So it worked, and so that's what I'm saying is that this war party, that is taking control of our country, and is taking us into these wars. It is not in America's interest. I have to repeat that time and time again because people have to understand that we are being abused. Our nation's being abused. Our military is being abused. We are being taken into wars that are not our wars. We have no reason to be in these wars. And by fighting these wars, these wrongful criminal wars, wars of aggression, as they are, we are causing great hardship for our soldiers, for our nation, for our civilians, but for our soldiers. And that's why we have things like what happened in Thousand Oaks, California.
Mm-hmm. And not to mention the millions of people suffering in Yemen or Syria or Libya.
Yeah, yeah. Of course. But we're having like something like an average of 22 Marines a day or 22 veterans a day committing suicide on average. And of course, we've destroyed whole nations. We've destroyed Libya. We've destroyed Iraq and Afghanistan. And, we're wreaking havoc across the whole region. And it's like, to accept this as normal, like I said in the back of my book, to accept this [S2] Yeah. [S1] this endless war as normal, is insane. And the only way you can break out of this nightmare is to understand the true source of it. Because it's not a mystery. It's not something that we can't understand. It's not something that's beyond our ability to comprehend. If you read my little book, The War on Terror, [S2] Mm-hmm. [S1] in 2 hours you'll have it all understood.
Yes, that's it is. Excellent in that regard. It's a concise treatment analysis of what is the war on terror. But I guess it is good for the war is good for like pharmaceutical companies who produce the psychotropic drugs that the soldiers are put on when they come back home and they suffer PTSD and these things. Yeah, who are owned by a few families, by the way. These companies like the Sackler family. Interesting. These are Zionist wars for a foreign government, Israel. America is being bankrupted, perhaps will be thrown aside like a exhausted husk, like the British Empire was in the 20th century when all is said and done. But such criticism, though, I think you're aware of this, opens you up for accusations that I think the ADL calls you anti-Semitic, you're anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist. You're obviously telegraphing Hitler.
They're going to say that. Yeah. They're going to say that. They've been saying that about me since 2001, November 2001, when I first wrote about the explosives in the World Trade Center. Mm-hmm. They call such criticism anti-Semitic. It's nonsense. But that's what they do. But I want to point out also that when we talk about this being a Zionist plot, you have to understand that the Zionist beast has a lair in London, in New York, in Hollywood, in Miami, in Paris. So, for example, right now President Trump is visiting Macron in Paris for the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War. Macron, Emmanuel Macron, is a Rothschild agent. He's a Rothschild employee, has been for a long time, and he was put in that place to be an agent of the Rothschilds. They had to stop that populist candidate Marine Le Pen from winning the election, so they put in this Macron. You have to understand that the hinterland of the Zionist state of Israel is the city of London, the city of New York, etc., where they have very influential comrades who control finance, like the Rothschilds, who control Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Who control what the Americans consume in news media, in entertainment. It's all a giant, in terms of media, it's a giant psyop against the American people 24/7.
Yeah, I mean, the character Arnon Milchin is a great illustration of that, where he produces movies, he's also a Zionist agent, meaning he was involved in nuclear espionage, correct?
Yes. He's the Israeli agent. He was the one who basically was the money man. He would control bank accounts held outside of Israel for Mossad for operations that they conducted. One of the operations they conducted, it's a group called LACAM, was to obtain the components for nuclear bombs from the United States and other countries to bring to Israel. And he was their main agent, and he was the guy that shipped something like 850 nuclear triggers. These are the little devices that trigger a nuclear bomb. He sent them to Israel illegally, of course. And when the Department of Treasury caught on to it, they indicted his employees, the American employees. But the guy behind it, Arnon Milchan, his name was not even in the indictment. So he's got like a Teflon. He's got a Teflon coating, right? And this guy's a very high level guy. He was working for Shimon Peres. These are the masterminds behind 9/11 and a lot of the big crimes that Israel's carried out in the last 30 years. They're terrorists.
Well, when your U.S. attorneys are like Michael Chertoff, you can run cover like this.
Yeah.
I was reading about some of the financial angle, just how the state of Ohio, the state pension fund, was investing in Israeli bonds. And this is caused kind of a mini controversy, but at the end of the day, the funds are being used to finance Israel, and it turns out the guy, the comptroller, is another dual citizen. This is how deep it is. And then you come across acting like a conspiracy theorist when you're saying, "Well, I don't know." Well, this is how these. I guess they call them Sayanim, I think is a term
for Sayan. Plural is Sayanim. It's like the mayor of Chicago is Rahm Emanuel.
Yes.
Rahm Emanuel, if you were to take that man and put him into a prison and start interrogating him, you would find out all kinds of things about 9/11.
Yes.
Because he was the mastermind in the White House prior to 9/11, for 8 years prior to 9/11, who was responsible for, he was the Mossad man in the White House. He's an Israeli agent.
For Bill Clinton, right?
Well, he was special advisor to Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
He was the guy that ran the Oval Office. He's probably the guy that got Lewinsky in there and that operation. But in any case, he was the guy that would tell Bill Clinton, "Well, we got to appoint this guy to the bench in New York. You got to appoint this guy to the bench in Connecticut." He's the guy that advised Clinton on what to do.
Is he the guy that got Hellerstein installed?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And what now Hellerstein, that's an interesting, Judge Hellerstein, yeah. What purpose yeah. did he serve in the, or what role did he serve in covering up 9/11?
This is yeah, Alvin story. K. Hellerstein was the federal judge in the District of New York who oversaw the tort litigation. You know, there were 3,000 families that lost somebody on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And of those 3,000 families, basically 2,900 of them took the federal compensation fund money, signed the dotted line that they would not litigate further, and went home and grieved at home with their money.
Mm-hmm.
There were 100 families, basically 96 families, I think it was, who held out for a day in court to find out exactly who was responsible for the loss of their loved one. And this became a tort litigation in the District of New York, held presided over by Alvin K. Hellerstein. Now, Alvin K. Hellerstein is a dedicated Zionist agent, as is his wife. But there was a fundamental problem with Mr. Hellerstein, in that his son is a lawyer in Israel, lives in Israel on a West Bank, in a settlement, and his son is a lawyer for an Israeli company that represents the defendant in the tort litigation, this Israeli company that oversaw passenger screening at the airports in New York City and Boston and Dulles on 9/11. That company is called ICTS. It was based in Holland. It's an Israeli Mossad company, and they controlled passenger screening at the American airports. So they were in the defendant's seat. And because the son works for them in Israel, the father had a conflict of interest because a primary family member, his son, is involved with one of the defendants in his case.
So obviously he recused himself, right?
He should have. He didn't, though. And I presented this evidence to the American people through my website and my writings years before case was solved. But it didn't get any traction. The New York media ignored it. They didn't write about the litigation very much. The judge just wanted to wrap the whole thing up. And what they did is they waged a war of attrition against the defendant, against the families. And one by one, every family was settled out of court until no one was left standing. So all the families from 9/11 have been settled. And there had never been one day in court. There hasn't been one minute in court to find any legal discovery for who did 9/11.
Hmm. So follow this. Hellerstein, who was appointed to the bench by Bill Clinton on the advice of one Rahm Emanuel, an admitted IDF veteran, I guess, but whose father was an Irgun or Hargana terrorist?
His father was in the Stern Gang.
Stern Gang, even worse.
Yeah. Murderers.
So he is an Israeli agent, but then... So he's advising – now this judge goes on who's appointed a Zionist, Rahm Emanuel, suggests Bill Clinton, who's fooling around with Monica Lewinsky, perhaps another agent. And this guy gets on the bench just before 9/11. Then that judge proceeds to run interference, clear interference and violations of all ethics and staying on the bench to stifle the
lawsuit. So they get this guy in position to handle the tort litigation before the case even comes up. You see, you have to understand that this 9/11 operation was planned decades in advance, so that the culprits behind 9/11, if you understand that, and you can look at it from a three-dimensional point of view or four-dimensional point of view, you can see that things were done before in order to prepare the stage. And things were done after but this is all planned in advance, and this was meticulous planning, and that's how it succeeded, because the American people are generally pretty very honest people mostly, and because they're honest people, they don't think like that, and so they're easily deceived. Honest people are taken advantage of.
Yeah.
And so we need to have crafty, cunning attack dogs who work for us.
Yes.
We need that kind of people to fight these people back, to resist them, to pull them out of the government, to put them on trial. And there's clearly no political will to try any of these people, but that's what we need. We need to have a big 9/11 trial, and because it's gone for so long, the list of characters involved in this operation is pretty long. but they have to be all arrested and held accountable for 9/11 and the war on terror. We got to start clawing back the money and getting the people arrested and cleaning, you know, what Trump says, draining the swamp. It's time to start doing it.
It's you mentioned this, the problem of the sort of the transnational quality or character of Zionism, meaning that everywhere where there is a Zionist Jew who identifies with Israel, he's an agent of that state, regardless of what host country he lives in, or even what citizenship he claims or has. And this
That's right.
A problem. You mentioned this Judge Hellerstein. There's always been a problem with federal judges and Zionism, because going back to Brandeis and Frankfurter, the minute you apply a little sunlight on their career, you find they were agents of a foreign foreign interest.
In
this interest of dual citizenship, secret societies, and the Parushim, and these things. This is a secret society, and you cannot be a judge. You shouldn't be a judge, be a member of secret society, because it contradicts your oath of office. Basic. But
Good for you.
I mean, I was reading a book called State Secrets by Leon de Ponsins, and this is dealing with the formation around the time of the Balfour Declaration. We talk about Zionist or Jewish Zionist power. It's sort of, it's not, at this time, didn't have a state, but it was there. It was all over the place. You know,
that's right.
It's hard to identify, which makes it hard to fight. But this is this is an example of the British Empire at that time, probably, I guess, the most powerful state on the planet. Soon to be, you know, I guess supplanted by the United States. But this is a letter that was written threatening the British Empire. It was under these circumstances, and I'll read this to you. It's called the Landemann Document. And it was under these conditions that the Anglo-American Zionists published a threatening warning to the British government by means of the Landemann Document, addressing the British government as if they were speaking to an equal. Remember, they don't have a state yet. They said, in effect, and this is what it gets, you forget that you did not give us Palestine as an unsolicited gift, the Balfour Declaration. It was handed over as a result of a secret bargain concluded between ourselves. We have scrupulously observed our part in bringing America into the war on your side. We call on you to fulfill your obligations in turn. You are aware of our power in the United States. Take care that you do not attract hostilities of Israel. Otherwise, you will come against grave international difficulties. This is 1919.
Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting.
Almost 30 years before Israel's formed.
Yeah.
So that's the problem. Yeah. I mean, there is Zionist or Jewish power, whatever you want to call it. There's agency, there's organization, there's AIPAC, there's JINSA, there's Hollywood and these things.
It's what it is, in short, is international gangsterism.
Mm-hmm.
It's gangsterism writ large. It's like we're living in times like when the James Bond books were written. James Bond would have these mega criminals, you know, who sought global control of something. And it's happened. It's real. He was right. James Bond was right. I think they killed Ian Fleming when he was 55 years old. I don't think he died a natural death, because he knew exactly what he was talking about. And he was making it into popular, you know, novels. And, you know, he was right. And that's exactly what we're living under. This is a form of gangsterism.
Mm-hmm.
These people don't play by the book. They take control of our government surreptitiously and by fraud. You know, they have people on their hook. They threaten people. They use extortion. They use blackmail. They use Jeffrey Epstein's, you know, and they use their bankruptcy lawyers and everything to control our politicians. This international gangsterism of Zionism has to be uprooted out of our country, out of our Western countries. And you know, that's why the boycott movement is so important, because this little Israeli state, when the world realizes its gangster quality, and when the people as a whole just say, forget about it, we're not going to buy their products, that state will have a hard time existing, because it has no friends in the world, really.
Yeah.
All of its allies are basically allies that are, as you said, you know, extorted to be allies or threatened.
Yeah, they're blackmailed and bribed.
Yeah.
Or both at the same time.
Right. And when you know, like Adam William Alan Sobrowski wrote in the foreword to my little book, The War on Terror, he said that when the American people wake up and realize what Israel has done to them on 9/11, you know, it's gonna be bad for them. And you know, he's right. He's absolutely right about that. But it's not the American people that do anything. It's our government. And as long as our government's hands are tied, nothing will be done.
Yeah, and the guilty parties are the Jewish oligarchs, the big Jews, the people. It's B'nai B'rith, it's ADL, and they more or less they've psychologically captured the little Jews, like they've done the larger population. So when we're criticizing Jewish organizations, we say the Jews, same way we say Germans or the Japanese. We're talking about organizations.
Right, like B'nai B'rith. B'nai B'rith. Yeah. B'nai B'rith is a Masonic organization of Zionist men, mm-hmm. completely secret, right? And it's like the super user of Masonic organizations, because the members of B'nai B'rith can belong to other Masonic organizations, but not the other way around.
Yes.
You know, because you have to be a Zionist Jew to be a member of B'nai B'rith. So that gives them super user privileges among other Masonic groups. And Masonic groups are all very much fashioned after this kind of Kabbalah,
yes.
Jewish mysticism stuff. Yes. Bunch of nonsense. But this is the Zionist framework that Masonic people who are Masons are indoctrinated with.
Yeah, it's great for secrecy, networking, and intrigue. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
It was a technology of the British Empire, the lodge, yeah. Right?
You know. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's an important point, and you realize is the they have no problem killing people, even killing little Jews, to achieve their objectives.
Yeah, you know. That's right. They kill a lot of them, and the Jew, the American Jew or the Western Jew, is actually a victim two times from 9/11, for example, because it's like they're tricked into supporting the criminals because of their tribal affiliation, and they're deceived like everybody else is.
Yeah.
So it's like for American Jews, or in this case, it's a double whammy. Whether they're Zionists or not, they're hit twice. And so, you know, I feel sorry for them, because it's a very bad thing when you have zealots like, you know, Netanyahu and Ehud Barak and the Rothschilds doing terrible things, and like kind of like dragging you along as accomplices because of your tribal affiliation. It's mm-hmm. very unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a serious problem. I don't exactly know what direct political action at this point is even possible. But of course, before we take any direct political action, you need widespread consciousness. And the first step
awareness.
To that, awareness.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And is reading,
absolutely right.
Reading your books, right?
Absolutely right. Tim, that's absolutely right. Is that like I said, you can't fight a war if you don't understand who the enemy is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have if you're deceived about 9/11 and the war on terror, then you are unable to respond in any intelligent way. So that the first thing you need to do is get the intelligence. You have to have the awareness of what really happened on 9/11 and what the war on terror is all about. When you understand those two things, then you will be able to be prepared to make the right decisions. And that's why I think my books are unique in the 9/11 research. Solving 9/11, The Deception Changed the World, and the bigger book is The Original Articles, and The War on Terror, The Plot to Rule the Middle East.
Yes, and all those where would you direct people to get those books?
Well, people can get them through the internet from bookstores like mm-hmm. Amazon or Barnes & Noble, online bookstores. I guess that's pretty popular these days. Or they can order them through me, through my website, bolin.com, because it's cheaper that way, bolly.com. And there's a donation button there. And for $50, they can get the entire set of three books, which is $20 cheaper, at least, than Amazon offers the whole set.
Which also supports your research and work. So.
Yes, yes. Well, yes, it does support me a little bit, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is I've been doing this for a long time. You know, it's been now 17 years. So it's not very lucrative to be the odd guy who's pointing out what happened on 9/11. No. But it's essential. It has to be done. It's like some people say, it's a labor of love. You have to do it. The truth matters. And it's really sad to see my nation and other nations so woefully deceived into such terrible situations like the war on terror. It's really sad.
Yes, it is. It's upsetting. But we can't let it. Can't fall into despair. You just have to continue on, and
that's right,
take some sort of action, at least spread the word so people can understand what's going on. That's what I try to do.
At least spread the word. That's right, Tim.
And also, you don't find yourself being as scared as much.
Of course not. Of course not. That's a very good point. Fear is something that they're pushing on us. You know, the alternative media, the mainstream media, they push fear because when people are afraid, they are easily controlled, and they control themselves. So it's a very useful tool for, you know, oligarchs. And when, as I'm saying, when you understand what really is going on, the fear dissipates because you don't have to be afraid of Muslims. You don't have to be afraid of Middle Eastern people. You don't have to be afraid of Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan. No, there's nothing to be afraid of. When you understand the deception, then you become emboldened and you no longer have fear. And that's a big plus.
And the black magic loses its power.
Amen. Exactly.
At that point. So, well, listen, Christopher, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I know you spent a good amount of time with me this afternoon. And I know we're speaking on the eve of the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day, 1918, the cessation of hostilities, the end of the great slaughter of World War One, which really shaped the 20th century, even the 21st century.
At 11 o'clock on the 11th, on the 11th day of the 11th month. That's right.
Very Kabbalistic.
He chose it that way.
Yeah.
That's right.
And to observe that day, and I know a lot of people now reflect on those days as we acknowledge, although this in the United States, this is more for Memorial Day for those who have fallen for the country, died in service of their country, we acknowledge. But really, I think the original idea of Armistice Day was sort of a lamentation of the slaughter, the disaster that it was. And that's how we should look at these things. We shouldn't just sort of take the sentimental approach and think about the soldiers who gave their lives. We should talk about, well, these soldiers who were tricked into being fodder for empire and be more critical of the decisions that were taken by the political leaders and the oligarchs to handle them, and maybe try them posthumously in history for the crimes they committed that led to the great slaughter in 100 years. And again, that's another thing where you know, not understanding the war on terror, not understanding World War One or World War Two or the Korean War or Vietnam and these things, we have a complete misunderstanding of these events, and we should question, really study the hidden grammar and secrecy, you know, the true story behind those events, so we could get a better understanding and stop this thing. You know.
That's right.
So I'll let you go. That's anything else? I mean, anything else?
No, I'm working on the another book, in which I'll put my writings from 2012 until today in another format, because the internet being a temporary thing as it is, I need to put this information down into a booklet that will last, because you know the war on terror is now part of our history, and it's going to be part of our history for a long time because it's not over yet, and it. You know, when I hear people at the Pentagon talking about staying in Syria or Iraq for decades, I just, you know, you want to wring somebody's neck. This is outrageous. It has to end. We've got to take our country back, and we've got to, you know, get rid of this nonsense carnage in the Middle East.
Yeah.
That we've been tricked into.
Yeah.
So, Tim, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, you certainly thank you, and you're welcome, and thank you for coming on the show. When I'm going to post this probably in a day or so. When I do, I'll send you the link.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Enjoy the beautiful winter out there.
Thank you. Thanks, Tim. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
So long. Bye-bye.
Bye. We'll be right back.
is not the way it seems.